それでは、ディスカッションの方。
We will start the discussion. At the end of the discussion, we will invite the audience to ask questions, but the panelists would like to engage in discussions amongst themselves. So for the initial 10 minutes or so, we would like to ask the panelists to exchange opinions. So are there any teachers or members who would like to ask questions amongst yourselves?
Any comment?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Professor Shinoda.
As he was thinking about the notion of politicization, what he really meant by that, what was his real thought? Because you'll note that I came back and said, well, the process is already politicized, but he obviously must have meant something more than the obvious. So I was wondering exactly what it was he meant by that. So that's to Professor Shinoda question.
Shinoda-sensei.
Thank you very much for asking that question. And of course, I'm sorry that I did not spend enough time to explain that point. And since we know that the nation state system in the contemporary world is not functioning very well, and therefore we recognize the need for developmental aid, but still we are not abandoning the need for nation states. So it's a bit paradoxical, but that's something we are doing at the moment. And we tend to think that for a peace building, nation state, nation building, has a very, very crucial, important role. We discuss SSR, DDR, judicial reform. We really, really tend to talk about state-oriented affairs when we talk about operational aspects of peace building. Probably because we tend to recognize the state as the very core issue of peace building. So having said that, and if a development aid is being engaged in exercise of achieving such a political exercise of achieving peace, and somehow at the operational level, if a development aid is even engaged in SSR, DDR, judicial reform, many aspects of state-oriented affairs, I think that what we do is to more to spend full energy in creating and examining a very, very policy-oriented and the political strategies of developmental aid. And I think I'm sure that you are doing that. But sometimes, even when we are talking about developmental aid in the context of peace building, we tend to get the impression that, from at this point, we abstain from engaging in their discussions because we are all developmental aid people. We happen to be engaged in SSR, but frankly, I do not want to get involved or something like that. Okay, if you do not get involved, that's fine. But you need to have, they need to have a very clear strategy. Political strategy to mobilize on how to make use of development aid for the very political purpose of peace. And if we can successfully do it, I think that very naturally we can recognize somehow limited, enshrined role, very modest role of nation state, which, however, we identify as a very core issue of peace building.
Shinoda 先生ありがとうございます。
Thank you very much, Professor Shinoda. Professor Mushakoji.
I have a question to Professor Tosa about a very important point he has made about the statement that the state, Charles Tilly's statement that war makes states. And then you combine it with the opposite aspect, which is that the state determine which wars are legal, and you have also yes, you mentioned that the state determine the illegitimate wars. And you seem to say that both things are contradictory, but personally, I think that it's the same. It's just a kind of will. The war makes states, and then the states distinguish between wars they want to fight and wars they don't want to fight. And what is happening with the war on terror, it is a war on those who make illegitimate wars, and in this way they legitimize a total war. And this is the vicious circle which we have to break. And my question is how to break this vicious circle, because if we don't break the logic of the war on terror, everything cannot develop in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or in other parts of the world. All the conflicts are now influenced by the war on terror. So my question is about how to go beyond this vicious cycle.
Thank you for your question. I think that there are the vicious cycle of wars, and it's closely related with the so-called neoliberal global governance. So maybe later, must ask some question to, in particular, to Shinoda. So maybe that is closely related to the issue of what is liberal order, an international order. So in my view, so maybe in the third world, our world usually destroys the state. But unfortunately, in the modern Europe, it's a war made state. So what is the difference between the world and this kind of different experiences? So maybe, so as you pointed out, developing countries deny to wage a war against each other because they got the independence after the world, after two major wars. So the prohibition of the use of force for conflict resolution. So, in the case of internal conflict, there is no rule such, in particular, with regard to internal conflict. So, and in particular, during the Cold War, for example, in the case of Afghanistan or Vietnam and Austin, for example, with regard to illegal trade, opium and cocaine and so on, for example, in the case of opium, the CIA covert operations contribute to the formation of illegal trade centering around Laos and so on. And that developed to international illegal trade. And in Latin America also, and Afghanistan is a typical case. So usually it's global hegemonies makes some wars illegitimate, but on the other hand, so you know, they continue to illegal and covert operation, covert wars against the evil. So in that sense, usually the wars closely related with peace in the core, in particular, democratic peace zone. So in order to stop this kind of the vicious cycles, so maybe we must cut a close relation between the so-called neoliberal capitalism and substructures, so neoliberal global political order. So in particular, with regard to this point, so close relations between the neoliberal capitalism and the neoliberal global governance, and so what kind of ideas, in particular, so Professor Shinode have about this point? So I want to know this aspect. If you have any comment or opinion, please.
Professor Shinoda.
What is your question then?
Yeah, so roughly speaking, so usually it's an English school and in particular it's a British, some of British and international study scholars emphasize some positive aspect of liberal international order. But usually the international liberal order has close affiliation with so-called neoliberal capitalism. And that kind of relations contribute to the deterioration of the situation, in particular in the developing countries, including Afghanistan and some of Latin America and Central Asia and so on. So maybe, so in order to cut the vicious cycles, so we need cut close relation between neoliberal capitalism and war zones, in particular, so, uncivil governance.
So your question is that whether or not I agree with the observation that we need to cut the relationship between the neoliberal capitalism and the...
But yes, I want to know what kind of idea do you have about the negative aspect of liberal international order? Particular, this,
I fully
recognize
the negative aspects. That was what I said, and I am quite a modest person. So I wouldn't say that it would be better or not to cut the kind of a relationship between the neoliberal capitalism and the liberal order, because it is too grand to attempt, and no single scholar can predict that is possible. So we need to admit that that is happening at a very, very hard reality. And in the study of post-conflict peace building, I don't think any single case can be identified as the creating, as the example of creating a new political community which is immune from liberal order. Every single case we talk about peace building, we assume that we have to be constrained by this liberal order. It's a matter of fact. The reason why it's a matter of fact is that partly because we agree with that order, but because it is so powerful that we cannot resist it. So what we can do is to just modify and... so it's a more concrete topics than...
I would like to devote as much time to comments from the floor. So maybe if there's time left over, we will bring back the discussions among the panelists later on. But at this juncture, we'd like to open Q&A to members in the audience. So if you would please raise your hand and state your name and affiliation and say who your question or comment is addressed to. Then we'd like to designate, and please wait for the microphone to approach you. Can I ask in Japanese as well? Oh, yes, please.
from Waseda University. My name is Inoue, a graduate school of political science. I'm studying, and I went to Timor-Leste last year, and I helped with the elections, and I was working with the UN and helping, and I lived there for some time. So from that perspective, I'd just like to ask for your views on what I have to say. Earlier, war is war, and you have to think of that as a reality, was one of the comments made. For one, well, the military is military, occupation is occupation. And this is a point that I think we should be thinking about more. For example, misconduct of UN staff is not talked about openly. However, this issue is a critical, big issue. Well, the military is the military. And I think there's similarity in the lines of thinking there, because not everything can be attributed to the individual. In other words, it's not just up to the individual. There are systematic issues that need to be resolved. That's one point. And UN efforts in peace building, we often talked about that more and more, but UN peace building, well, viewed from the third world countries, their efforts may have negative impact to third world societies. For example, within society, there may be division as a result of UN efforts. And the UN and other occupational presence may bring about social division. That's one negative aspect we have to think about in Timor-Leste as well. Although the UN has intentions of bringing in liberal ideology and high affinity, well, there are sects that have higher affinity and those who are not, and this leads to bigger division in society. To this view, if I could entertain the comments from the other panelists. There were quite a number of questions, so maybe not on a one-on-one basis. Maybe we could have several questions from the audience and ask the panelists to respond in a group form. So next question, please. From Nippon University. Is the microphone on? From Nippon University, my name is Nishigoka. And before I entered university, I was a journalist. I worked for the newspaper, and I covered conflict countries. I visited dozens of conflicted countries, and based on my experience, well, I feel a little strange listening to the level of discussions today. So in form of maybe half a question, half a comment, I have 3 points to make. For those in the non-conflict countries, they emphasize the cause, the root of the conflict. Dr. Cushing as well, you talked about climatic change and other, and North-South issue and neoliberalism cited by Dr. Tosa, and they're all true as points. But going to the actual field, that country, it may be true, the roots, the causes might be true, but the people there are asking, why us? Why are the conflicts occurring to us? And I think your perspective not can respond to their needs and their questions, because some people feel that there's something wrong among themselves as to what they're doing. And when listening to your discussions, you're modest in that you're questioning yourselves what your country has done. But we are in an air-conditioned room drinking coffee and everybody's smiling and you shake your hands and then we say goodbye. But we're maybe a little self-complacent, and I was being a little too provocative, so that was my first point. And my second point, if you land in various airports of the world, you know whether that country is dangerous or not at the airport. And that is because you feel whether that airport really, well, if there is not solidarity within the country, even at the airport, you sense that it's risky, it's dangerous, And so, as Dr. Safi was saying, you need a state. And for peace building, you need the framework of the state, first of all. But the state, what is it? There was no definition or specification of what a state is. There are national states, modern states. But if you go to the field, there is no state. For example, in as Dr. Safi from Afghanistan is saying, many of the conflicting states, if you go there, there are only warlords or interested parties. And they are only fighting to preserve their own self-interest. There is no state in those countries. The farmers in Africa, they're very good and kind-hearted. But actually, you often hear about their past, and they were involved in massacres themselves. They killed. And anarchy reigns in and it's the community and maybe an Islamic community or a state or some sort of framework is necessary. And when you think about peace building, you have to keep in mind what type of state is desirable for that society or that area. And earlier in the discussions, you talked about national society or civil society, rights, obligations, NGOs, responsibility, war, conflicts. These are all words that came out. But the way these words were used, well, the definition we used in the developed countries and the definition of words in the developing conflictive countries, the definitions, I think, are probably different. And to discuss these without these differences in definition, I think we're talking about castles in the sky. It's not meaningful. Thank you. Next question, please. Well, because of a lack of time, if you could be brief.
Rula from PCS at Tokyo University of Foreign Studies. And all of you, I think, talked about this, but perhaps Professor or Dr. Christian is the best to answer it since, because of his experience, about UN reform. And I think when most people talk about UN reform, it has to do with especially reform of the Security Council because of the Permanent Five system. And any reform that were to take place would, under my understanding, would have to be approved of by these Permanent Five, which would mean that they would be willing to give up or to decrease the influence they have over world affairs relative to other countries. And any reform that would have to take place would not just have to take place now, but would have to include some sort of mechanism to ensure or allow reform in the future so that it can align itself with the current world system at that time. So if more states are created or states are split or separated like this, and how willing or do you think this is actually possible that these Permanent Five would agree to any reforms that would take place? And if so, obviously this is not going to happen in the near future. How long would this take, and would it even be important at the time that it took place, or would it be too late for the UN to reform itself? Thank you.
ありがとうございます。次の質問お願いします。
Thank you. The next question, please.
簡潔にお願いします。
Please be brief in your question.
In short, my question is for Professor Cook. I just want to say lately what's happening in Lebanon about the concept of civil society and how it developed. But I want to just mention a fact and to ask Professor's opinion. Lately in Lebanon, the Lebanese group are divided into two groups called 8th of March and 14th of March.So the civil society was able to develop a new society, a new like organization under the name of 11th of March in the middle. And at the same time to say, when people are together, they can make a difference, like one to one man. But the problem, how can they make it if the international community is not funding them? If the international donors are going towards these two major groups?If peace negotiations or any aspect towards peace reconciliation is done through these two major parties, how can the civil society develop itself? Thank you.
ありがとうございました。次の質問お願いします。
Next question, please. Ms. Abedin-san.
So Abedin from Tokyo University of Foreign Studies. My question also to Prof. Norman Cook. You mentioned that the strong civil society in Lebanon,which altered the state in terms of providing public service for the community member was a main obstacle to, you know, to maintain a strong state. But comparing that with Darfur, I think the absence of strong civil society organizations in Darfur led the young community member, the young men in the community member, to turn their backs for traditional leaders and go and form armed groups. Now we have big problem that not just the reluctance of Sudanese government to negotiate, but who is a representative of Darfur? Who could represent Darfur? We have the fragmentation in Darfur inside the IDP camps because the civil society organization is lacking for capacity to attract community member and to attract the loyalty of community members. I feel that when we have strong civil society organizations and we have the will of the leaders of these organizations to negotiate and to reach to a negotiated resolution, I think it's easier and automatically we have community members compliance with this stuff. So what's your idea about that?
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey West. I'm authoring a document called A Green Print for Life, and I have my master's in peace education. What we've heard today may be perspectives to what is called the new phenomenon, but I'm not really hearing anything that's completely new. We know what's going on in the world. We're still looking at peace or conflict from a criteria of separation, race, gender, creed, language, orientation, etc. And it's kind of my belief that from these perspectives, peace will never be achieved, and we will never be able to answer Professor Isazaki's question about what can be achieved at the end of this conference if we are continuing to look at conflict from this perspective of separation or fear. At this point in time, there are ideas in science and spirituality that are merging together to support an idea of oneness. And at this level, energetically, we are all one. And there is a well-known Japanese scientist, Masaru Emoto, whose work with water is showing this to be quite true. From this perspective, conflict no longer is seen from separation, but rather a competition for human energy. And it's from this perspective as well that we will not find the root causes from the way I think most of you are trying to look at the root causes. The root causes arise from what we learn from family, society, and personal experience, and finding this root cause means asking a question. What fear is so present in another or in myself that is leading to a choice to dishonor another aspect of the oneness that is life? Creating the structural change requires helping humanity to connect to this new relationship, to what I call life, capitalized, and empower them to make conscious choices that honor the self, that honor others, and that honor the natural environment. So searching for this new approach to peace, as the banner says on the wall, does not mean reconciling our relationships based on criteria of separation. It means reconciling our relationship to this larger energetic aspect called life. So unless we are able to resolve our own relationship to life and heal the negative energy that is within ourselves, can any of us in this room truly say that we have the right to go out and teach peace education to anybody else? Peace flows essentially from one's being. So empowering this leads to the structural change that will produce the peace that I believe we all say we want, but in reality, society is moving in exactly the opposite direction. There's evidence to show now that 9/11 was a lie. And even recently, a representative of the Japanese government stood up and asked very boldly in the Japanese parliament about information relating to the truth behind September the 11th. There's information saying that the U.S. Federal Reserve is a fraudulent criminal organization. Lots of information is coming out at this time to say that things aren't working in our society and empowering people with new information to make new choices. I'm going to cut this short, but developing the new system requires an important reordering But it also requires us to identify our relationship to life and make choices from those accordingly.
次の質問お願いします。
Other questions?
Very short three questions in order to provoke your thoughts. First one, first question is, are all conflicts innately bad? Second, if it is yes, why did human society from very beginning engage in conflicts? Third, if society is changing every day, if one section trying to preserve the existing order, others trying to change that thing, is it possible to avoid conflict-free society in the future? Thank you.
Yes, I am a Venice, University for Peace, Charter Center, Costa Rica. I just wanted to pick up on the one of the trends of peacelessness that Professor Cushing pointed out, which is the environmental climate change issues. I was surprised that nobody else picked up on that. I personally think that that's the most serious problem that we are facing and going to face. If you look at it, most of the discussion has been very anthropocentric, and humans have been fighting each other. We are predatory beings as a species. But I'm wondering what all of you think. If it's not the case that if we address the species relationship with other species in our community of life, this might not be the way of finding a common cause that might unite humans. Because the climate change issues are so complex and the phenomena are accelerating very much. I met a few months ago with Professor James Lovelock, who believes that the International Panel on Climate Change, an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was one of the co-winners of the Nobel Peace Prize last year, do not sufficiently take into consideration the interactions between the biotic community of the planet and the other Earth systems in their modeling projections. And I'm wondering if we're not reaching a very similar situation to the Cold War of a mutually assured destruction scenario, but in this case it's between humans and the rest of the community of life. And perhaps we should. And I'm surprised also that Japan is the country that took leadership for the UN Decade of Education for Sustainable Development. It's my main financial agent country. Why isn't this being discussed integrally in this room?
よろしいでしょうか。それでは、
Thank you for all the questions. So with these questions in a bundle, we would like to ask for reactions. So may I suggest that 4 minutes each should be allocated to the questions, starting with Professor Mushakoji.
I will just support the last two statements about the importance to have a change of mind and not just stick to the Freudian kind of analysis, but look into the oneness which is in the depth of all our personalities. This is where probably the Japanese approach to diplomacy is creating some problems, because we believe in oneness and we don't like to criticize Burma and other countries because they do something bad. We want to interact and gradually change the situation. So this is one problem. The second thing about the decade for education for sustainable development. I am part of a project in Nagoya with Dr. Cook here. We will join a meeting there. And one important aspect of it is biodiversity and multiculturalism. According to the UNESCO definition, biodiversity and multiculturalism are together. We should accept the plurality of life and the plurality of mind, of cultures. And this is what the change which is important to develop. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is probably, as it was mentioned, we are looking at the global problems, structural problems, and we don't start from the individuals themselves. And this is where we need to develop not a universal oneness or a kind of beautiful dream. We need the dream, but on the other hand, we have to be specific about each person who is experiencing insecurity. And this is where we have a plurality of situations, and this is the tension between plural situations and oneness, and the fact that there are interests, multinational interests, and also hegemonic interests, which are just trying to deny any development in that in the right direction. We have to combine all these aspects, and as it was mentioned, we live in a gray zone. It's not a black and white situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Shinoda-san.
I would like to concentrate on the first two questions. Okay. So let me answer in Japanese.
About the misbehavior of the peacekeeping forces, yes, we are cognizant in this industry, so to say, and there is the peacekeeping work group when Japan was on the UN Security Council. So we are aware, and maybe it is conducted because a military is a military, but there are wrongdoers in the non-military as well. Now, there are operations where you do have to use a military where there are non-qualified personnel, but this is inevitable. But as long as we said that 15,000 force were to be sent over, maybe there were some non-qualified personnel who engaged in mischief. And then should we refrain from sending peacekeeping forces if they are not the top quality people? Or even if that is the case, should we send people to those field and sites? There is no perfect judgment. However, according to the consensus of the international community today, it's probably better to send the peacekeeping forces to support as much as we can. And there are many reasons, because there is the national interest for the USA and national interest for other countries. But according to theory, because of humanitarian perspective, we should not ignore human suffering. And academically speaking, and I have to be abstract talking about nation states, but all over the world, the framework of a nation state is changing. That's changing because of decolonization. And you might as well leave it alone because it's someone else's country. But then it leads to the problem of the global order. After the decolonization process, we decided that there would be a certain consensus for the global community. But now we have started to think that that order would not suffice. And then we do not have an alternative order, and in order to transfer to the next appropriate order, massive effort is required. So with all the faults and flaws, we inevitably are accepting the so-called global order of today. Of course, we should engage in further discussions whether this is acceptable or not, but that is a reality anyway. And what is occurring because of the situation is those who wish to maintain the status quo, they have to be responsible to maintain the current order. So the key word would be responsibility. About the second question, because of my business, I do visit conflict-ridden areas. And of course, you cannot understand the cause of the conflict so easily. And if you ask questions to the local people, they don't explain clearly. But there are many situations where you can learn from the local people. If you try to build peace, of course, well, there will be different difficulties, but finally you have to grope through the darkness and try to make a leap. You can't see everything. It is not 100% visible, but you have to make a judgment and decide to jump and leap when you see to a certain degree, because there is only limited knowledge, limited information. But in order to fulfill your responsibility, you have to brace yourselves and jump in the dark. Now, whether you have seen everything, whether you know or do not know, that's another issue. Just because you want to fulfill your responsibility, you try your best. And the more you become engaged in, the more responsible you are held. So you have to go into a quagmire, so to say. There is no going back. But if you don't become engaged, what do? You go nowhere. So I am not explaining myself clearly, but the point is, maybe it's just simply unavoidable, inevitable. So we shall have to reflect upon ourselves whether what we are doing is appropriate or not. If we are being engaged in aid just because it is inevitable, then we should check our actions one by one as much as we can. Thank you.
I'll try to be brief and just do a quick response to some of the comments. On the first one about the misconduct of UN staff, it's not just foreign military staff that either sexually exploit local people or are involved in corruption, like financial corruption or others, but it's civilian staff as well. There was a huge case 3 or 4 years ago in West Africa where UN and NGO staff were getting sexual favors for food and other non-food items from displaced camps and refugee camps in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. So this is a huge problem. I think it's particularly acute in a conflict country or a post-conflict country where you have international staff coming in real life-and-death positions of power. They can really have a huge level of power, which you normally wouldn't have in their home countries or their home societies. I think there has to be a huge amount of professional training and careful selection of people who go on these types of missions. Even the best sort of intention, even a person with the best intention, can fall prey to temptations or to other things in these situations. One of the problems, especially for the military, but for civilians as well, is when the host government, when the government giving these staff or sponsoring these staff or a UN agency doing it, finds out about the problem, their first response is to cover it up. And if they send the person home, there's certainly no sort of criminal proceedings or investigation or anything like that. They want to protect the reputation of the organization, or they want to protect the reputation of the mission or something like that for the greater good of everybody. I think you have to hang these people out to dry. I think you have to crucify them, put them in court, put them in jail, and make examples of them, because it's a particularly heinous example where people are in life or death situations and you're exploiting their vulnerabilities for whatever reason. On looking at the second set of questions about root causes and conflict, where there's no state in a lot of these conflicts. In the 13 wars that I've worked in on the front lines, there have been state actors, but there have also been a plethora a lot of non-state actors. And this is what clearly came across in a number of the discussions today, is that we're not dealing with the wars of 200 years ago, we're dealing with modern wars where the war economy and the number of different actors who all have different roles. Sometimes the police during the daytime are the police and they're running checkpoints, but at night they're out on the roads and they're either doing assassinations or they're robbing you or whatever they're doing. Local actors, quite often local communities will try to have a self-defense force to protect themselves from the chaos of a war, of a modern war. But quite often those kind of self-defense forces turn on the people and eat their own community as well. When I was running refugee camps in Zaire from the Hutus who'd come out of the Rwanda genocide, in the daytime, the Interahamwe kids were trying to control and dominate the camps. But at nighttime, when the new Rwandan government was crossing the lake and attacking the refugee camps, it was the kids in the Interahamwe who were now protecting the camp. So all of these actors in war play multiple roles, which are changing and evolving all the time. On UN reform, UN reform is possible, but it depends what you mean by UN reform. As I said before, in my personal opinion, the UN does exactly what the great powers want. Now, there's a lot of talk and a lot of international pressure to reform the Security Council, to expand it out. The British Prime Minister just last week or the week before endorsed India's seat on the Security Council. That would probably be fine. But the fundamental problem with the UN Security Council is that it's not democratic. Sure, Canada and other countries get elected to it once every 10 years, and so there's some sort of fuzzy democracy there. But in fact, the Security Council is the self-appointed dictatorship which runs the UN. So unless you get rid of the Security Council, the UN is not going to be what a lot of people think it should be, which is maybe some sort of independent, global, universal organization for good. The UN was created as a political institution for security and to safeguard the interests of the Permanent Five. And the great marketing strategy has been to get all the countries involved and to support it. That's not saying that particular UN agencies don't do good and that UN staff don't do good work, but you have to understand the fundamental essence of the UN is a political security institution run by the Permanent Five. That's what they are. I'm just trying to cut through things. But on this, maybe these two points about sort of human energy and the oneness of us all and getting away from separations and climate change, I think climate change is the greatest threat the world faces, and or at least the greatest threat that human beings on the world face. You know, we're actually a very small part of the biosphere, the human population. And I think that if the worst case scenarios, if climate change come true over the next 50, 100 years, the world will continue to exist. Life will continue to exist. This period of extinction now is the sixth major period of extinction that we've had in world history. And in previous extinctions, you know, something like 96% of life on Earth was killed. Plant life, animal life, insect life, you know, whatever it was killed. And then slowly over millions of years, life came back and things changed. So I think the world will continue. I think life will continue. I'm not sure about us. I'm not sure about human beings. And so I think that that the oneness that we share, the common denominator we have, is this vulnerability to what we're doing to ourselves. But this idea of the oneness of us all, I think, has to be put into balance with diversity. And we had the example of multiculturalism. I'm from Canada. And in Canada, for all the time I was growing up, for 40 or 50 years, the Canadian government shoved multiculturalism down everybody's throat. You were forced to do it. All your taxes paid for it. It was a huge effort. And after 40 or 50 years, the government had to admit that it completely failed. Ethnic groups and different... Canada is a country of immigrants, just as many other countries are, and except for the indigenous people who we kill and exploit and shove into reserves. But, I think you have to have a balance between respecting the diversity, you know, that those things in your culture which make Japan unique, I wouldn't want to see destroyed. I wouldn't want to see amalgamated and washed out in some global gene pool, just as I wouldn't want that for Canada or other countries or other cultures and stuff.
So I think one of the great extinctions that's happening, of course, is the loss of culture, the loss of language, the loss of these traditional histories that each of us are coming from into these sort of urban, metro men and women who live in these big cities, and we've lost our past. And I think this is part of the alienation that a lot of people feel, and one reason why there's so much internal war with each other. Somebody mentioned something about conflict-free society or conflict-free environments. Conflict is an inherent part of human nature, and it's an inherent part of our relationships with each other. There's nothing wrong with conflict. The problem with conflict comes about when it turns violent, or you're threatening or using coercion. The secret to happiness or to success is to have constructive conflict management. So if I like chocolate and my friend likes vanilla ice cream, and we go to the ice cream store and we want to buy one bowl of ice cream, we have to talk about, okay, we're going to get strawberry because I like chocolate, he likes vanilla, but strawberry we can agree on, and we've worked it out without, you know, having a fight or something like that. So that's the peaceful resolution of the conflicts that we have, either our internal conflicts or our conflicts with each other in our families, in our workplaces, whatever it may be. I think that's enough. Thank you.
Thank you. では、土佐先生、お願いいたします。
Dr. Tosa, please. Just one point. It's a comment to a comment. Simply said, a politics of impeding in peace. Well, we were talking about anthropocentric society. But when we're talking about peace, we're talking a peace of people of mankind. I don't think it's peace for the environment. But if we're back to the environment, it's like a boomerang effect. And if you exclude people, it's going to come back to you. It's the same as the failed state concept that Shinoda-san was talking about before. And to some extent, it's unavoidable because in the issue of oneness as well, when you build something, you have to exclude something. It's unavoidable. And sometimes there are fluctuations, vagaries. And I don't know, the person who posed the question is already gone. I was going to comment on a comment made by that person, no longer here, but he was mentioning when he landed at the airport, security for foreigners. Well, if you have an authoritative state, maybe it's safer in terms of security, based on my experience. And I don't want to offend any Indonesian, but Indonesia and Jakarta Airport during the Sukarto administration, it was very safe. But Iran Jaya, East Timor was in a very dire state. So for Cambodia as well, before UNTAC came in, and Shinoda-san knows well, but was anarchy, and there were gunshots frequently heard during the daytime. And even now, with the security situation, I really don't want to offend any Cambodians, but Hun Sen's regime, because it's dictatorial, to a certain extent, it's safer now. So in a nutshell, whether it's safe or not, simplistically, you have to look at who it's safe for, and within the people as well. For example, in Kabul, maybe safe in Afghanistan. But you have to think of, is it safe for whom? So in the case of projects as well, the same thing can be said, PCS project, and more specifically, the jargons SSR, DTR, and all the acronyms, but who benefits from these projects? So these are very basic issues, but we need to continue to look at them. And furthermore, peace. Who is it peaceful for? And we have to think about who we are excluding in order to build that peace, because in peace building, there's always the possibility that we are excluding someone. I just wanted to add that. Thank you. Professor Cook, please.
I like that question about, in fact, I put the two questions together about anthropomorphism and spirituality in the framework of peace building, conflict resolution. I certainly agree with the thought that we are anthropomorphic. There's no question about anthropocentric, sorry. I think the approach is clearly anthropocentric. As we begin to talk about the state and people who are marginalized, very often we're talking about people who are living in a cultural, spiritual, epistemological reality that is indeed not Western, is not sitting within the framework of our rationality, our pragmatism that's emerged in certainly the Anglo-Saxon part of the world where I live, but who are essentially tribesmen, very often, or clansmen, who are sitting in the framework of a worldview in which they are a lot less anthropocentric than we are, sitting in this room right now. As we begin the process of working with a lot of those people and trying to bring assistance to those people within the framework of democracy and declining nation states, I think it's very important, and it's been our experience in Canada, again, and around the world where we've worked with the idea, that we really do have to get into the notion of extending group rights. That's why when I was talking about democracy that I said, let's think a little bit about group rights, because it's those people and extension of group rights to them that may in fact rebound into the world of the Christian, the world of the Jew, the world of the Muslim, in which we separate out by our very epistemology that relationship between man and nature. That there are lessons for us sitting in parts of the world that we believe that we've gone to help. So I think that we need to engage the notion of group rights within a democratic framework that allows them to reciprocate rather than simply be in a symmetrical relationship or an asymmetrical relationship even to power with us. I don't know if I'm clear about that point, but that's what I believe. I guess with respect to the personal view, to extend a little bit on what you were saying, we also have to be a little bit careful about entering into a fundamentalism in our own epistemologies, even if they're good. That we have to bear in mind that we live in a pluralistic universe, and that there are others who may hold deeply held personal belief systems that differ from us, and that we somehow have to interact in our world with them, and to find a language, and it really addressed the question of the man who had left, the journalist, in which we're able to do exercises like this, not because those of us in this room who have had, I'm sure, a myriad of experiences, you know, I can't even imagine who's in this room right now in terms of what their eyes have seen. But we've all pretty much seen a lot of pain in conflict and violence in conflict and suffering in conflict. But here we are in a room discussing process, discussing categories of our concern. But we have to find a language that releases power. Power in order to indeed help those people and help ourselves in that relationship. So that was my answer to him. That yes, of course, I understand the world of authenticity that he's addressing. But none of us have a monopoly on that authenticity or that experience of authenticity. And we have to be very careful in kind of raising that flag that way, it seems to me. The other question, I guess, was about conflict, and is conflict necessary? I believe, yes, I'm committed to the belief that both conflict and stability are necessary for growth. I'm an evolutionist, and I think that we evolved that way. Debilitating conflict, I guess, is the term I use, rather than violent conflict, because I think that sometimes violence is a part of conflict. be it psychological violence, be it emotional violence or physical violence. And I don't particularly hold one more sacred than the other, by the way, because we can quite damage people psychologically without even touching them. Regarding the UN, I also very much agree with Professor Cushing, and I won't go there, but I think that what I was really saying is that the emergence of organizations and networks of common space among citizens on the planet can become a very, very powerful driver, not only in UN reform, but in kind of global governance reform. I'm far more concerned with that idea than the UN as an institution specifically, because I do agree that the Security Council controls the UN in no uncertain terms. Darfur, I was asked about, and civil society. I very, very much agree that the production of bandits and militias in Darfur exists, but I don't believe that it was caused by the absence of civil society. I believe that it was caused by the breakdown of the political jurisdiction system. So I don't link those two automatically. I think that it's very important to have a strong civil society, and I don't necessarily believe that it's a civil society or a government. I mean, indeed, what you want is you want a good civil society operating in a good balance with a reasonably strong government. And part of the role of that civil society is to go to the fringes of that mandate of the government, of governance, and talk to all the people there. And if a government is any good, it'll be able to accept the permeability, and that was why I used that word at first, the ability of that civil society to reflect back through it what it sees, what it means, to become an instrument in the democratic process, if you will. Again, common space for common security. Lebanon civil society, that was the most difficult one, yeah. I can't answer that question because I don't know why the donor community are not funding the third force. Partly because it's new, I would suspect. Partly because people haven't really had time to understand who's there, what they're doing, what it would do in relationship to their ideas of peace building in Lebanon. There's also the question of whether or not the third force has established itself sufficient partnership with organizations in donor countries. It's not just a relationship with donor governments, because you're a civil society, they are a civil society force and should have civil society partners in donor countries that are strong and can advocate for them. So that's my view on that. But I really technically don't know the answer.
Thank you very much. So, Professor Sophie, please.
So, I will be not so long because especially our journalist friend, he has left already about the state in Afghanistan. But never mind, I will make a small clarification for that. So, as by my mean, there is no state in Afghanistan, it doesn't mean that Afghanistan state has been withered away with. Geographically, we are. Nobody can take Afghanistan even an inch of that. The Russians couldn't do it. Previously, it was not done. In the future, also, it will be not possible to finish the Afghan state. Mechanically, the state exists, but I refer to the definition of sovereignty, that if internally a government is not strong enough to control its population, to enforce its law inside, and also to govern all its territory, or cannot control its borders from the other side, the terrorists can enter and even can reach your capital, Kabul, 50 meters far from the palace, enter the hotel and can blow it up. There is no sovereignty. Sovereignty is very weak. And for those friendly states, even either they are in our neighbors or in any part of the world, if they think that they help Afghanistan-like countries or other developing countries in their sovereignty in establishing their own independent government, they must help their people to establish their government. They must not impose a person or many persons like previously in bipolarity of the world. They were doing competing with each other for finding friendly state here and friendly state there. If a state is based on the power of its population and people, then nobody can finish that state, and it will be incompetence or full in their power in order to establish their relations with the world, in order to bring peace inside and contribute to the peace outside their own country. That was my comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. 大変あの時間が
I'm sorry, we don't have any more time. We wanted to have further discussion, but we don't have any time left today. So if you don't have discussed it fully, we have some time left tomorrow for further discussion, so you can raise further questions tomorrow. I would like to thank all the speakers and the participants for your presence. Thank you very much for being here. With this, let's conclude this session. Thank you very much.
皆様本日は大変お疲
れ。Thank you very much for being here with us today. Tomorrow, session will be in a different room. It is room number 906. It is at the opposite side of this building. We are looking forward to your participation tomorrow as well. And please leave some information receivers on your tables. Please make sure you don't bring them with you. Thank you very much for your participation.